Tim Hurdle and Dale Husband are our political commentators today. Kia ora korua, welcome both, thanks.
Tēnā koe, Catherine. Hey, Tim, kia ora.
Kia ora, Dale. Good morning, Catherine.
Well, Dale is long-time broadcaster and Radio Wātea presenter, hosting current affairs programming there. Tim Hurdle's a former National Party senior advisor, was the National Party's campaign director in 2020, a director of several companies, including Museum Street Strategies, a public affairs firm. Look, the Prime Minister obviously just back from the United States and NATO, but everything, goodness me, everything just pales given what has happened in the last 24 hours. Can I just get each of your reaction to this attempted assassination on Donald Trump? I guess what it says about where our politics is at. Tim?
Well, I think we'd spent the week before arguing about the Democratic candidate and what his mental competence was, and now we've got this situation, which just seems incredibly amazing. The whole situation is just so volatile. I mean, you always seem to think, oh, it'll never get any worse, but something like this happens and you're just horrified. I mean, we were probably close to a civil war if that thing had actually hit him. It's a quite incredible situation. And I think the modern world, we see so much of it on social media with cameras everywhere now. It unfolds just in minutes. And I think we're all a bit dismayed about how the world works these days with the speed of information flying and the hot tempers that seems to inflame.
Dale?
Yeah, well, first thoughts are with the dad who was killed there, Corey Competitore, quite obviously. And really for Trump or something like this, really not unexpected. He's such a polarising figure. The gun laws in there allow everyone to tote weaponry, and sadly, that whole attitude is affecting our nation here as well. We just saw another shooting in Mount Wellington. Drive-by shootings have become regular. So we're not untouched by this situation with Donald Trump. And as I say, when you dance with the devil, the situation for him is not so unexpected. But as far as comparing the coverage, Catherine, I'm a bit disappointed at the barrage of news, and I can see why. But, at the same time, we just heard of 13 school kids killed in an airstrike on a school in Gaza. 90 have been killed in supposed safe zones in Gaza. And the coverage of that part of the world, as against Pennsylvania, is very stark. Trump will get the boost from it, as this fist pump suggests, and he'll roll into the presidency. And, of course, that makes many across the world, including myself, very nervous.
Tim, that's just perhaps the final thing we'll talk about is the impact on the campaigns from here, and certainly the early commentary out of the United States. Harking all the way back to the last attempted assassination of a then-sitting president, was that this avoided assassination, thank goodness, and may well see a surge for his campaign. It's interesting also to see the tenor that each of these leaders takes from now on. And
yeah, well, we were heading into the Republican National Convention, which was the big set piece start of the campaign and proper. Now, recognising that we're getting midway through July and soon we'll be going to the polls. So America will be going to the polls. So this is only going to get hotter from here. A just incredible thing to kind of contemplate how that will have an impact on the race. It'll probably polarise, and that their elections are very different from ours. They don't have middle people deciding the elections. It's whether you can motivate your side of the fence to come out and vote. And for the Republicans and for the Trump supporters, this will be very motivating for them, I would have thought.
Let's look at what feels like a very long time ago now, which was the Prime Minister's trip to the United States, to NATO, and the circumstances surrounding that. How do you come at this, Dale? He seemed to perform creditably on a world stage, but also there's, the NATO summit itself is part of this shifting geopolitics and New Zealand's potential role in it. How do you view that?
Yeah, well, firstly, to Christopher Luxon, holds himself well. He's met a lot of high-profile people in his career. I think he has to temper when he just refers to down to, because he used that sort of term when he discredited the second tier visitors to Japan, and now he saw the head honchos of the globe and down to the head of Iceland, which is unfortunate too, but it's just some of his style. He's a personable character, and he represents well on the international stage, not taking that away from him at all. But at the same time that NATO was going on, we had the expert mechanism looking at New Zealand's shortcomings in the UNDRIP, or the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, got very little press. And from my perspective, Māori perspective too, I would suggest the fact that it didn't get prioritised in any of the conversations was another reminder that we've got a long way to go addressing Indigenous rights in this country. But as far as a performance meeting with Joe Biden and all the heavy hitters of the global politics in the US, I'd have to say that Luxon represented us well, and relationships are really what life is about. So he would have forged some good ones there, and we'll hold him in good stead on that international stage going forward.
Tim.
Yeah, I think it was a pretty significant opportunity for New Zealand to be at what is the pretty preeminent security discussion in the world now, for Luxon to be able to chair the Indo-Pacific Four, because Albanese wasn't there, where they met with Japan and Korea and Australia. Those four powers are the those three powers are pretty important to New Zealand regardless, but also the wider conversation with North America and Europe that NATO represents. It really was an important discussion to be at. It was a good opportunity. I think he did do well. It was an observation I saw that, you know, this isn't the silly shirts and communiques about doing better. It was a pretty serious conversation. So it's important that New Zealand is engaged in the world and able to be part of those conversations, to perhaps even provide a perspective of a smaller, relatively independent nation.
Let's come back home then, and all eyes will be on that CPI rate coming out Wednesday, I think it is. There was some softening, some interpreting it as a significant softening, in the Reserve Bank's statements last week, Tim. And in domestic politics at the moment, one of the largest issues without question is just the stress on households and businesses. How are you reading the importance of what happens on Wednesday?
Yeah, well, of course, always the thing is the numbers coming out afterwards, but if it is as predicted, it will start taking the pressure off the Reserve Bank to squeeze out inflation. We're already starting to see the markets starting to price in lower interest rates coming up even earlier than expected. It will probably reflect the fact that the economy is very flat, that people are doing tough times, and that will hopefully portend that there will be some interest rate cuts and some opportunity for economic growth to come back and start bringing back the jobs that we've lost.
Dale, it's always for governments to hope that the fortune breaks their way in the timing of economic recoveries. And our electoral cycles are short, as we know. There is so much stress on so many households at the moment.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Catherine. And look, it's one thing to look at the Reserve Bank, its mechanisms, and the rise and fall in the interest rates. But for many people, many, many New Zealanders, I'm sad to say that they're worried about 75 cents if they've got the extra to be able to pay for that piece of grocery item that's in their trolley, nervous as they go to the checkout, wondering if their card's going to be declined in a public way. So, look, there are many people who are just absolutely at wit's end here in New Zealand. And I really feel for them too, because so many of them are seeing their sons, their daughters, their mokus say, "Oh, listen, I just can't cut it here in New Zealand." And they're just jumping across the Tasman in huge numbers, 60,000 people leaving our country. And sadly, the loss of human capital is enormous, and many of them will never return.
Just jumping to those migration figures to Australia, very, very high at the moment, Tim. Not just anecdotal, but coming out in the latest data.
Yeah, and it usually is a strong correlation between the growth of the Australian economy and our own economy. When Australia does well, it starts taking people off us quite a lot. When our economy is matching it, that we don't lose so many, I suspect, with the fact that our economy has been in recession for quite some time, and the Australians always able to dig more gold out of the hills, quite literally, that they're able to afford to pay for the people to come over. They're taking our best and most qualified, as Dale points out. Often they're taking our trained professionals and police and those sort of things. But I guess the interesting question is, we've got the new tax cuts coming in at the end of the month, and hopefully that'll put some money in people's pockets too. But yeah, migration is going to be a big stress, and it does have quite wide ranging implications, not only for GDP but also for some of the planning and the housing questions that we're facing.
Dale, what are other parties making of this? Are we hearing anyone really seizing on that extremely high outflow to Australia in particular and trying to double down? If they are, they're struggling to get much coverage, aren't they?
Yes, they are at the moment too. And of course, the news cycle is throwing other issues up. The Greens have long maintained their stance that we need a wider tax reform, certainly the Māori Party the same. But in the latest polls, if I'm reasonably accurate, I think the Greens were sitting at 12.5%. Their issue is more with Darlene and the fallout from that situation at the moment. But I think anyone with half a brain would realise that we do need to have major tax reform here. The wealth of the nation corralled into the hands of so few is deplorable. And so we need to get a shake-up there. It might not come this time around, but you'd hope that as the political cycles unravel across the next couple of decades, we'll get a fairer tax system that addresses the inequality of wealth in this country, which sadly has been the way it is for so very long. People are starting to not realise that there are alternatives, but it needs bold political manoeuvres in order to ensure that. And I think our country would be better off if we did take this whole situation more seriously and not so much worry about middle-aged landlords or middle-class landlords, often middle-aged as well, I might add, but started to really look at some sort of reform that makes a fairer tax regime a reality in this country.
All right, let's look quickly at that latest poll. Actually, as always, the caveat, it's one poll. It's the Taxpayers Union Courier poll. It will be good news both to National and to Christopher Luxon, however. The Greens, to Dale's point, relatively static. So was ACT. New Zealand First up a fraction. Te Pāti Māori down absolutely a fraction. But what sort of a fillip would that be to National, given the focus has been on their poll performance ever since the election, Tim?
Yeah, I would have thought it was a pretty positive read, because it sort of says they've got through the budget, they've got through the questions that were being asked and before the budget as to whether they could deliver, and they've got a budget out there, they've got programs underway, and they've got the transition underway, and they're pretty much polling where they were 12 months ago, and there's the relative stability about the coalition that's starting to bed in. They'd be very happy with it. The other interesting fact was the perceptions about the direction of the country have flipped from being negative to a net positive. It's a pretty thin track, but that's sort of an indicator for me that there's an acceptance that government is probably starting to find its feet and starting to move forward.
Your take on it, the party that won't be happy with it, again, the caveat, it's one poll. Labour down 3.5 points to 25.9% in this, Dale. And I guess that comes back to your point. And the opposition got the choice to sort of sit back and hope that a government does itself harm or seize the moment, seize the agenda. The problem for Labour in some ways is how and when it sorts out its tax policy, Dale. And it might not be in a hurry to go public with that or to go through the process.
Yeah, and I agree too, Catherine. There's a bit of a charm offensive on at the moment with Chris Hipkins going around the regions and accompanied by his senior caucus colleagues, and that is important. They'll be mindful that they've slipped somewhat, and to Tim's point, I've got to agree that many New Zealanders are actually uplifted by this coalition's approach. Not all, obviously, but some encouraging signs for Christopher Luxon and the ACT and New Zealand First Coalition. I just wonder too, with the situation with Donald Trump, whether that will embolden those who see a sort of right-wing approach to politics as the way forward for New Zealand. But obviously, for the centre-left and left parties, they've got work to do. And it starts now. We're all mindful that there was criticism of Labour that they almost meandered to the polls and endured the results that see them now in opposition. So it is it's imperative that they get out onto the streets and sell to the voting public their ambition, their goals, their policies to force a change in government into just over 2 years' time. So the charm offensive is vital, and it is important too that they do put policies on the table early so that voters know exactly where they stand, rather than what happened last time around, where they, in many ways, sleptwalked to the loss that they endured. So there's work to be done by Labor, but it's a long way out from an election.
One of the matters that's interesting about this government is that it has been a case of move fast and break things in several areas. Education is one, with Eric Stanford working at breakneck speed on some of the reforms there. Chris Bishop on housing is another, Tim, and he has gone where so few have been prepared to go. He's talked about wanting house prices to come down. We're now starting to see work on the possibility of these city deals with regional councils, with local councils, and talk of some bipartisanship involving Labor. So is this an area where he's making haste with some success?
Yeah, well, this is the problem with the city deal concept, that it's it got talked a lot about without people actually focusing on the detail. But the reality is, if you want to make a 10 or 15 or 30-year deal for a region, you're going to have to cut across many changes of government, both at a local and central regional level. So this is where they do have to think about how they can create some bipartisan confidence that the deal will survive a change of government. So that's where those things are going to become quite crucial. It creates an opportunity for Labor, because Labor have had their policy bonfire, and then they've had questions around their delivery. They've got to restore their reputation for competence, and here's an opportunity to be in the conversation in a bipartisan and a proactive and a positive manner, not just knocking over the government of the day every day. So it is a good opportunity, I think, for Labor to try and get involved.
Dale, you mentioned the Greens' latest issue, and what has been just a series of them is Darlene Tanner. What did you make of their handling of the report that they have not publicly released? Parts of it have been released. Her resignation from the party, and now this public calling for her to leave Parliament altogether, so far unanswered. What have you made of it all?
You know, the silence is deafening from Darlene, isn't it? And you've got to wonder just how difficult life is for her. She hasn't come out and played the mental health card. Others have. And then, you know, society, even the parliamentary precinct, cut people some slack. I can understand how difficult it must be for Darlene. You know, she's put a lot of her life into establishing a reputation that got her on the ticket to go into Parliament. There's a lot at stake for her here. And it's concerning to me that reports come out that she likely knew what was going on in her husband's business. I'd suggest many relationships where both don't exactly know how the other half earn their quids or spend them. And, you know, I just think there's a little bit more to come out about this, but I do have some issues as well with the due diligence that all parties are obliged to undertake when they put a person's name forward. How well do they know that person? What is the reputation? How are they considered around those who live by them and know them? You know, there's a duty of care that parties have here, and I just wonder whether or not that was as front and centre as it needed to be for Darlene there, with tikanga and support from within her own caucus. There's more to play out on it, but the silence from her is deafening and, of course, frustrating for her colleagues.
And Tim, National's had its own issues with that question of doing the background checks, but the big question for the Greens really is whether they invoke the party hopping, and that is a real conundrum.
Oh, absolutely, because that sort of goes right back to some of the original founders of the Green Party. I guess the problem that Darlene Tarner probably has is she probably feels like, well, it wasn't me, I didn't do it, and I'm not really that keen to give up my opportunity and my job here. So this will be the challenges. How do you persuade her now? Because this is the only way to do it now is through this legislation. There won't be probably a resignation at this stage.
Well, I think National had intended to abolish the so-called waka jumping law, but possibly a coalition partner not so keen on that, Tim, so that's off the agenda.
That's an interesting timing.
How so?
Oh, well, you know, this is the thing. The coalition government, those laws, they look terrible until you actually need to use them, I suppose, and that's probably the conundrum that the Green Party faces.
Now, staying with New Zealand first for a moment, and what a successful tweet that was, starting all sorts of mischief last week, Dale, but in the end, outing quite a bit of information about the Aratiri stranding, and now we are hearing of the advisory group's report going to government suggesting, not based on this, but on a whole series of things, it might be time for a new organisation to run the ferries. What did you make of how that all played out last week?
Well, I had a chat with Winston actually through the week, and was saying New Zealand First members drive taxis and trucks, and they also work on ferries. So he got the inside oil, was able to say, hey, it was an autopilot issue. Somebody had gone to get a cup of coffee and the ferry ran aground. Either way, you know, that could have been a tragic situation. So we know that human error can result in, you know, big vessels running aground or planes crashing out of the sky. But we can't accept that, can we? And so it's appropriate to have an investigation to see, well, who would be best in running that organisation at the moment. It's in the hands of Kiwi Rail. Most want involved with that organisation want to retain the status quo. But it is absolutely vital for our international reputation that that ferry is run effectively, safely, on time, on budget, all of these things we've come to accept, because let's face it, it is Highway 1, and we certainly can't afford to have errors, human errors like that, besmirching the reputation of not just the ferry service, but of the kaimahi who were involved in it. You know, no one looks good when a ferry runs aground, that's for sure.
Well, the lawyer in the union's insisting that no hot beverages were harmed or involved, indeed, in the autopilot accidentally being triggered, Tim. But the question now seems to be why no one could override it for a critical minute or so. What did you make first of the politics, Mr. Peter's politics, and then second, how this plays into that larger question of whether a different outfit should be overseeing the service?
Oh, I think Winston's always pretty good at having sort of those tip-offs and ideas that capture the public imagination. And I think holding the button down for 5 seconds, not being in the manual, just sounds like one of those classic situations where it's of human error or not running down the instructions properly. But that's what happens. I guess the concept of changing the structure of the ownership of the ferries, or whether it's a separate entity, I don't get very excited about that, because at the end of the day, it's the same ships going back and forth. It's about how well they're managed, who's doing the managing, and who's sailing the ships. So it'll probably be the same people, just would be in a different format. But, you know, these things, people like to think there might be an easy way of doing it.
Thanks both. Tim Hurdle, Dale Husband.